teachings of Islam. And of course, this was due to the fact that these champions and these masters and these divinely appointed imams and leaders of Islam were cast aside, and in their place, tyrants and despots and arrogant individuals came to power, of course, which ruined the Muslim Ummah slowly but surely. Now, in this kind of environment where we find that this moral decadence has been increasing, we find that Imam al-Jawad spoke about moral virtues. He spoke about this reformation of the Muslim Ummah in order to bring it back online. Now, one of the things that we also saw was that there was a relative influx of wealth at the time of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Now, sure, this wealth was pretty much, you know, limited to certain groups of people or certain strata in the society. So we did have this kind of very un-Islamic class system and this very un-Islamic and unequal distribution of wealth. Nonetheless, we do find that overall there was an influx of wealth in the Muslim Ummah. So when one of the companions of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam asked His Eminence about blessings, you know, in their different various shapes and forms, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam replied to the companion and said that the blessing that is not thanked for becomes a sin that is not forgiven. And so we find here, dear brothers and sisters, that being ungrateful to the blessings that the Almighty Allah has given us is one of the sins that are not forgiven. And unfortunately, it is something that many of us do not take into consideration. We must realize all the various different blessings that we have in our lives. And so here, as we find in this conversation, Imam al-Jawad is pointing out to this fact that these blessings that we have in our life are something that must be appreciated, and we must be grateful to the Almighty Allah. And of course, this is, you know, something that we find even in the Holy Quran, where ungratefulness is equated to a shirk and to kufr, and that one who is not grateful and one who is not thankful to the Almighty Allah for their blessings is committing a sin. And how unfortunate it is that we have so many countless blessings in our life. If we start to count them, we will probably not be able to finish, right? Blessings such as health, life, you know, the ability to breathe, the ability to see, the ability to hear, the ability to speak and walk, or, you know, our families, our wives, our children, our parents, our siblings, our friends, our companions, you know, our relationship with God, you just keep on going and you will find that there are so many blessings in our lives. And, you know, when you appreciate the blessings that you have, not only do you build a stronger connection and a more intimate relationship with the Almighty Allah, but at the same time, you begin to have this very positive energy and this positive spiritual feeling within yourself, because you realize all of the different blessings that you have. And of course, on the other hand, if we don't appreciate these blessings, we will not be able to create a healthy and intimate relationship with the Almighty Allah. And along with that, we will constantly have a negative view about our lives because we aren't taking everything that we have. And of course, the farther we go from these spiritual and moral ideals, the more, you know, we go towards the path of darkness, and all of this in itself becomes a sin that is not forgiven. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
And now we invite you to listen to Shaykh Vinay Keita about Imam al-Jawad alayhi
salam. Issues. There's the age of the Imam and the color of the Imam, na'udhu billah. Probably the color was used as a pretext to cover was covered, then they would go to something else. Because they knew that this wouldn't really stand up. There's no way Imam Rida would accept these arguments. No way. They, of course, but they protested anyways. Because cultural. It was seen usual. It was seen to be against the, which were jahil, and the reality of the true Islam and the seerah of the Prophet. Which shows that we don't need to learn today that there are cultural norms that are against, whether it be in our communities or our families, that are contrary to the teachings of Islam. Rather, these conflicts occurred very early on in Islamic history, in the early period of Islam. And these are some of the lessons that we can learn from the life of Imam al-Jawad, which is we have to ask ourselves, where does our allegiance lie? Does our allegiance lie with a set of cultural norms, with a set of constitutions, with a set of bylaws, with a set of this, you know, lives matter, and this charter, and that charter, and this charter, and that charter, the ones that we write with our own hands? Some of it may be true, some of it may not be true. Some of it may be right, some of it may not be right. Or does our allegiance lie with the Book of Allah and the Seerah and the Sunnah of the Masumeen? This is a very important test for us in how we treat others, in our marriages, how we conduct them, all of these things. All of these things. These are all the things we can learn from the struggle of Imam al-Jawad.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administration.
Round the world with reporters.
EU leaders accused the Hungarian government of casting democratic values aside with respect to judicial reforms and press freedom. However, analysts say their real issue is that Budapest is not towing the line with respect to the war in Ukraine. EU affairs ministers met on Tuesday to debate so-called EU values in Hungary. On her way into the meeting, Hungarian Justice Minister Judith Varga slated the European Parliament for criticising her. Varga says that the European Parliament does not respect EU values, does not respect democracy and rule of law. What do you think?
The European Parliament has full democratic legitimacy to adopt the resolutions in case they see the political need to do so. So that's the only comment I have.
The EU has so far spent 10 billion euro on weapons for Ukraine. EU nation Hungary is against the policy, and that seriously irks Brussels and Washington.
There is no chance to win this war. So therefore, what we should do far more energy invest into to convince everybody that the only solution is ceasefire.
Experts say Prime Minister Orban is correct to suggest the EU is concentrating too much on propelling.
He has a point, because here in Brussels you hear people saying, okay, it's always about Ukraine, it's Ukraine this, Ukraine that. But we should not forget the Palestinians in Gaza. We should not forget the Syrians. We should not forget the Sudanese.
It's clear the Hungarian government is a major thorn in the side of the EU project at present. However, Eurosceptic parties in other member states are on course to make significant gains in forthcoming elections, helped on by the cost of living crisis. Therefore, the problems might only be starting for the establishment here. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
It's no secret now that you don't get much for a pound in Britain these days, and households are the ones feeling the pain.
The food price, they went really up and up. You can't buy lots of stuff now. You need to reduce.
It is absolutely increase in high level. They increase a lot. Every day you will go to supermarket, 10-20p every single day almost.
At more than 19%, food inflation here remains at the highest levels in over four decades, meaning an even greater squeeze on the budgets of low-income families. One of the drivers of inflation, new research shows, Brexit.
What is clear, and I would agree with that, is that Brexit has lowered people's living standards. Voted for this nonsense, and now people are beginning to regret it. But it's a little bit too late.
The government admits the costs are getting out of control and is working with food producers, farmers, and supermarkets to explore ways to reduce the pressure on households and to find out if middle companies are taking out too much profit. Trade unions say higher costs are not trickling down to the workers. While there have been strikes and higher pay settlements with some sectors, the gap between people's pay and price increases is substantial.
What's happened, of course, is this year people have taken wage rises that are below inflation. That means that their living standards are falling. So next year, guess what? They're going to try to catch up. And so that's why it's going to be more persistent than a lot of central banks thought and a lot of people in the markets thought.
The UK's central bank has increased interest rates 12 times now to try and tame inflation, but the rate is still higher here than in all G7 nations. And that has meant more people falling on hard times. Today, one in seven Britons is skipping meals due to the rising cost of living.
So many people not being able to afford food or having to skip meals is a sobering thought in a wealthy economy like the UK's. But that is the reality of the inflation crisis and of post-Brexit Britain. Saeed Pariza, London.
For the last two decades, Afghanistan was a war zone under the U.S. occupation, and Afghans faced violence, insecurity, and poverty in that era. Also, free media paid a heavy price for reporting the truth. On May 31, 2017, a truck bomb killed more than 150 people near the German embassy in Kabul. Among the victims were three Afghan media workers, including Press TV's cameraman Habibullah Hussainzadeh. 5 years on, his colleagues and relatives remember him as a brave and dedicated professional.
Martyr Hussainzadeh was a very kind-hearted and brave person. He dedicated himself to the society. Habibullah was passionate and committed about his career. He loved journalism ever since he was at school and got a job at a local media office. Then he enrolled in university in journalism and worked with Press TV to become the voice of the voiceless.
Hussainzadeh was not the only Press TV worker who lost his life in Afghanistan during U.S. occupation. Syed Farhad Takaddusi was another Press TV media professional who died in line of duty. According to the Afghan Journalist Safety Committee, 150 journal workers were killed in the country between 2001 and 2021. Rights bodies blame the UN for creating a climate of bloodshed and impunity.
Of course, the United States and NATO war on Afghanistan took a lot of lives from Afghan civilians. Journalists were among those thousands of innocent victims who lost their lives in a war they weren't involved in. Unfortunately, in the past 20 years, none of the killers of journalists were held accountable. The U.S.-backed government and judicial bodies intentionally and unintentionally ignored the cases.
Despite the risks and challenges in Afghanistan under the U.S. occupation, Press TV was one of the main media covered the most underreported stories and gave an alternative perspective from Afghanistan. These are the faces of Press TV's fallen heroes in Afghanistan. They sacrificed their lives from a war-torn country. They will never be forgotten by friends, colleagues, and Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The Resistance Festival in Brussels has gathered Palestinian rights campaigners from across Belgium and beyond. Israel's murder of innocent civilians and the regime's ongoing illegal activities in the occupied territories has been highlighted.
The Nakba has been going for three quarters of a century now, and we're talking about brutal colonialism and occupation in its most ugly form imaginable. People are angry.
Apartheid, ethnic cleansing, segregation, siege, all for ethnic cleansing and colonialism.
Tel Aviv authorities continue to destroy Palestinian homes and develop stolen land for settlers. Activists are calling on everyone living in the EU to stop buying Israeli products.
Yes, I think there should be boycotts. I think there should be sanctions. I think there should be punishment.
I think it's absolutely vital that we continue to support them in their struggle against fascism and imperialism.
We are here, helpless and hopeless sometimes. We feel... And we cannot protect our people in Gaza. This is painful, very painful.
Even though the United Nations classifies Israel's activities as illegal under international law, the EU seems to suggest that both sides are to blame for the occupation.
We are consistently urging all parties to exercise maximum restraint and not to contribute to escalation, but to the contrary.
When it comes to Ukraine, there is no such mixed messaging from the EU. Russia has always been a story. Rights campaigners say Palestinians will be free eventually, insisting it's simply a matter of time. Given that the European Union is so willing to impose sanctions when it falls in line with the wishes of the United States, those gathered here are calling on EU leaders to finally muster some courage and put Israel under real pressure. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has won another term, garnering 52.16% of the vote. Right after the announcement of the runoff results Sunday night, opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu thanked the 25 million Turks voted for him, especially youth and continue the struggle for democracy with his alliance.
The means of the state has been entirely pledged to one person. I could never stay silent when your rights were violated. I could never tolerate you because millions of refugees came here. I fought for all this, and I will continue to fight.
For her part, Good Party leader Meral Akşener congratulated President Erdogan on winning a new term and called her supporters and those who cast their vote in favor of the opposition candidate not to feel pessimism or loss, assuring that election is the most fundamental display of democracy.
Don't forget that we are still here at the parliament. We will continue to fulfill our responsibility. I want to congratulate Mr. Erdogan for being elected, but he should not forget that the polls conveyed messages to him as well.
Akşener delivered her speech from the Good Party headquarters in Ankara, rather than the area opposition alliance designated to celebrate their victory in the case of winning. Analysts believe the only reason those six agreed to nominate one candidate, despite their ideological differences, is to gather their efforts and oust Erdogan. And with that, not much is likely to be divided.
I think the divisions and resignations initially that the table of six gathered President Erdogan. On the other hand, I think the People Alliance and ruling AK Party will be facing a lot of challenges because Turkey is already struggling with economic crisis, the refugee crisis, and some problems with the neighboring countries. The People Alliance must work harder now that they will govern the country.
More than 25 million Turkish citizens voted for opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. This election had been seen as Erdogan's biggest challenge, for the Nation Alliance was very close to unseating him. Now that the presidential run is over, political parties have already started preparing for the upcoming local election in 2024, with Erdogan promising his supporters a win in both opposition strongholds, the capital Ankara and the economic hub, Istanbul. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
So were tear gassed, abused, and arrested by police in Paris. The Western mainstream media broadcast shock and alarm at state brutality towards. Many of France's yellow vests were glad the subject was reported upon, but the group which has been subject to more French police brutality than any group in recent memory wonders why their weekly protests and mistreatment are still under a media blackout.
Every Saturday for nearly 5 years, the yellow vest in the streets. In the big cities and the small towns, we make more democratic and economic rights, and we won't till we get them.
When a woman who was not participating in a 2019 yellow vest demonstration and had been shot in the neck by a tear gas grenade was just judged to be co-responsible for her injuries.
The judge said that the mother, who had gotten lost in a strange city while visiting her daughter, should have known that serious incidents had occurred at recent protests. The decision refused to find fault with the state's actions, seems to negate a citizen's right to travel freely, and will likely scare many away from even observing a yellow vest protest.
Un état totalitaire.
We aren't in a dictatorship, but in a totalitarian situation. The state wants everybody to keep quiet and to agree with whatever they say. This lack of democracy is why the yellow vests began in the first place. It wasn't over just gas prices. This woman's situation is one dramatic situation, but there are so, so many others like her.
On June 6th, a million-person march is expected. The fifth in the ongoing fight against a 2-year hike to the retirement age by presidential decree. Police brutality is expected to be even more rampant than at the previous such march on May 1st.
Pour leur physique de venir en manifestation.
The people are afraid for their own physical safety when they come to a protest now. There are so many arrests, so much violence, and this is the reason why the number of people joining us dropped, even as our national problems keep growing worse.
Besides their Saturday marches, the yellow vests are present at seemingly every public protest in France, and often around Europe as well. They regularly contend that they are willfully ignored by the government and media because the basis of their movement is economic and political redistribution. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Al-Quds International Institution has held its annual meeting of the Board of Trustees in Damascus. The meeting was attended by Palestine's ambassador to Syria, Syria-based Palestinian factions, and Syrian President Assad's political and media advisor, Buthayna Sha'ban, who is also board secretary in the institution. She called for the unity of the Arab and Islamic world in order to liberate Palestine. She set the case of Syria as an example for Palestinians that victory is undoubtedly the result of steadfastness.
Arabs have returned back to Syria. The difficult experience Syria went through for over a decade is a beautiful lesson for Palestinians that those who believe in their cause the most will triumph. President Assad's presence in the Arab League summit is not just a victory announcement for Syria, but also signals the failure of huge plots made by strongest world powers.
Speakers highlighted the heroic resistance of Palestinians in the battle codenamed Revenge of the Free in the Gaza Strip. They called for confronting Israeli attempts to Judaize Al-Aqsa Mosque, reiterating that Quds will remain the eternal capital of Palestine. The meeting comes following an Arab League summit and reconciliations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, as well as Syria and the Arab world. Such developments, according to speeches delivered, indicate that the world is heading towards a multipolar system where the West's hegemony is demolished. Speakers underlined the importance of reminding the world of the Palestinian cause and the suffering of the people of Palestine caused by the Israeli occupation. Despite the decades-long Western double standards, institutions like this believe that Palestinians' steadfastness will eventually lead them to restoring their rights. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
UN bodies issue fresh warnings about the impacts of huge fan gaps in Afghanistan. The latest such warning comes from the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Afghanistan, which says urgent funding is needed to avert an imminent large-scale humanitarian catastrophe. Afghan experts are also worried about funds drying up and the international community turning its eyes from the war-torn nation.
Definitely, the only way out of the Afghanistan crisis is constructive engagement between the ruling Taliban and the global community. This year, hopes of heeding Afghanistan's appeal for financial aid are fading, and it is very threatening. Shortfalls in funding absolutely deal another devastating blow to the Afghan nation, especially the most vulnerable citizens. We will witness more poverty, unemployment, and devastation in Afghanistan if funds continue to dry up.
The United Nations has launched a humanitarian appeal for $4.62 billion to assist nearly 24 million Afghans in 2023. However, the appeal has received very little support so far, with only 6.4% of the required funding secured. This has forced many aid organizations to scale back their activities, leaving many without help.
Aid cuts are a disaster. People like us are eyeing international assistance. We have no job and income, so relief aid can be a lifeline for us. Some are sick, they need free treatment. Some are in dire need of food and cash aid. People will die in their houses and on the streets in the absence of global aid. They have no money for themselves. First, they are relying on God's mercy, and second, on the relief aid.
Major aid cuts, Western sanctions, and the freezing of Afghan assets by the U.S. are exacerbating Afghanistan crisis. Afghans have been calling on the U.S. to release the funds and to lift the sanctions, saying they are hurting and punishing innocent people who are already suffering from poverty, famine, and hunger. Afghanistan is facing a severe funding shortfall that threatens the lives of millions of Afghan people. Aid agencies warn that the global community must act urgently to prevent a humanitarian disaster. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The Limelight.
In Britain, more than 500,000 appointments and operations have been cancelled due to the strikes by doctors, nurses, and paramedics. Specialist doctors in England are demanding an increase in their visiting fees and say that these wages have been lower than annual inflation for a long time. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British Newsmill has covered this story and tells us more. National Health Service bosses are braced for a summer days. Union leaders suggest that a 50-day hike would not be enough to stop. In comments unearthed by the Daily Mail's union, the British Medical Association, BMA, said if ministers were to offer consultant consent, it would still be just a drop in the ocean. NHS consultants on average of £128,000 a year, and the union separately demanding a 35 new doctors. The comments from Vishal Sharma, chairman and deputy chairman of the British Medical Association's Consultants Committee, threatened to escalate the bitter dispute between ministers and health unions. Disputes with nurses and junior doctors remain unresolved in England, raising the prospect of all three coordinating strikes for the first time. Unlike nurses and junior doctors, consultants are yet to strike, but more than 30,000 are being balloted and look certain to vote in favour of industrial action after 86% did so in a test ballot in March. The vote closes at the end of June. In comments made on the little-known Senior Review podcast, Dr. Vishal Sharma said, "We now need to start from scratch and say what should a doctor in the United Kingdom in 2023 be paid. We can argue that it should be 50% higher. The government can argue whatever it should be. And I have to say even 50% is still a drop in the ocean compared to America, Australia and many other places." Dr. Mike Henley added, "When you consider the 17 years of training, the stress, difficulty and complexity of what you do, you're worth every penny." Dr. Mike Henley added, "So the question to you lot is, what do we do? Do we go on Newsnight and say we demand a 50% increase?" Well, I would, obviously. Britain's Health Secretary Steve Barclay on Sunday, 28th of May, held firm on the government's position, saying it would not improve its pay offer to nurses, which includes a one-off payment equivalent to 2% of salaries in the 2022-2023 financial year and a 5% rise for the 2023-2024 financial year. It was rejected by members of the Royal College of Nursing last month, despite the union's boss, Pat Cullen, recommending that members should accept the offer. The Royal College of Nursing is already balloting its 300,000 members for further strike action over the next 6 months. When asked by Sky News whether the government would resume talks with the union, Health Secretary Steve Barclay said, "Not on the amount of pay. Talks with the British Medical Association over junior doctors' pay have also broken down after the union rejected a 5% offer," with Steve Barclay telling the BBC on Sunday, "They haven't moved from 35%. That's the key." Dr. Vivek Trivedi, the co-chairman of the British Medical Association's Junior Doctors Committee, said, "We've been very consistent in what we are wanting, and that's to restore the pay doctors have lost over the past 15 years, which is roughly 35% up to April of last year." In response to his podcast comment, Dr. Sharma said, "Consultants have quite simply had enough, and this is why we're being forced to ballot for industrial action." A health department spokesman urged the British Medical Association to carefully consider the likely action on patients. Dame Helen Stokes Lampard, chair of the Academy of Medical Royal Colleges, said the decisions were clinically led and first and foremost about improving the quality of healthcare. She said, "I know the team have consulted with medical experts, specialist clinicians, those who commission services and a great number of patient groups every step of the way." She added, "Achieving consensus has not always been easy, but it has been worth it. The fact that the program also reduces unwarranted variation across the country and helps to tackle the backlog as well as freeing valuable clinical time are also huge bonuses. But general practitioner GP leaders are worried about the knock-on effect that this will have on family doctors already struggling to cope with increasing demand. Dr. Margaret Igbo of the Royal College of GPs raised concerns that the changes could overload family doctors. She said plans to reduce the pressure on hospitals cannot be implemented in isolation without considering the impact on general practice and the huge workload and workforce pressures that GPs and their teams are facing. The British newspaper The Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. Junior doctors will strike for at least 3 days every month over the summer after new pay talks with the government broke down as they upped their pay demands to 49%. The British Medical Association, the BMA, which has been demanding a 35% pay rise, said the government's offer of 5%, which was also offered to nurses and paramedics, was not credible. The junior doctors will now walk out for 72 hours from 7 a.m. local time on Wednesday, 14th of June, to 7 a.m. local time on Saturday, 17th of June. But a Department of Health source said the union had unrealistic expectations and had not only refused to shift during negotiations, but actually demanded more. It is understood the British Medical Association negotiators proposed a multi-year settlement which would have seen doctors below the rank of consultant receive a 49% boost between 2021 and 2024. The strikes are likely to undermine efforts to tackle record waiting lists and leave patients waiting longer for care. Over 500,000 appointments and operations have so far been cancelled as a result of NHS industrial action by the likes of doctors, nurses and paramedics. Junior doctors held a 4-day strike in April and a 3-day strike in March, which caused the cancellation of 370,000 appointments and operations. Around 1 million NHS staff on the agenda for change contract, which includes most employees other than doctors and dentists, have accepted an offer of a 5% pay rise and a one-off bonus payment.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahruddin was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, Al-Mu'allim. This program is about the life and the works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia scholars and ulama all across the world. During the History of Islam, I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Rouhani and Shaykh Fadai. Shaykh Fadai, salam alaikum, welcome to the show.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, salam alaikum to you.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the life and the works of the late Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Husseini, mainly known as Agha Najafi Quchani, the author of the book Siyahat Gharb and Siyahat Sharq. He was considered as one of the most outstanding urafa of contemporary era of Iran, whose works and whose moral and ethical and mystical trainings have influenced the upcoming generation of the ulama. Shaykh Rouhani, give us some information about the early life of Agha Najafi Quchani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Husseini, known as Agha Najafi Quchani, was born in 1295, living in Mashhad, Isfahan, Najaf, Quchan, and Qom. So he died in 1363 in Quchan. So among his teachers, we can mention some of the great names like Mullah Muhammad Kashani, Jahangir Khan Qashqai, who was one of the great hakim and mystics in the history, and Sayyid Muhammad Baqir Durrshahi, and also Akhund Khurasani, Sayyid Muhammad Kazim Yazdi. They are also among the great scholars who were among the teachers of this Ayatollah. And of course, he studied in the cities Mashhad, Isfahan, and Najaf. Among his works written by him, we can mention some of the very well-known kind of books like Sayahat-i-Gharb, Sayahat-i-Sharq. And there are some commentaries on some of the du'as, the prayers like Du'a-i-Sabah, which is also a kind of commentaries and explanations about these du'as that is written by him. Of course, in this du'as, we have lots of, mystical teachings.
Yes.
In these du'as that this Ayatollah was interested to comment on them. And of course, there are some other kind of philosophical book as well, which is written by him, like Risalat al-Tufahiyya of Aristu. He has a kind of translation or commentaries on this work. And there are some of the well-known and main works of this Ayatollah Quchani.
What is outstanding about his life is his return to Iran and stay in Quchan. It was not a known place on that time, not very much known for his hawza, but for 25 years, a very ethical point and moral lesson for some of the ulama who migrate to the big cities of religion, for example, like Qom, Mashhad, and stay off over there. But in the past, they used to get back to their homelands, okay, and be the source of benefit and the source of teaching for themselves. Like, for example, Sheikh Muhammad Kuhestani, northern Iran, he was a great marja, and so many other scholars who get back to their homeland, preach over there and preach Islam over there, like Agha Quchani. Shaykh Fadai, what is known about him is his ethical teachings, his moral teachings, mystical teachings, and the book Siyahat al-Qarm. Give us some information about this aspect of his life.
Imam of God, yes, as you said, he cared about a lot about morality, and both of the books that he wrote, Siyahat al-Sharq and Siyahat al-Qarm, was based on morality. Siyahat al-Sharq, it is known as his biography, but he wrote his biography in order to teach a lot of morals and some experiences from his story. And then Siyahat al-Gharb, which is a story based on a journey of a person, imaginary person who is traveling through the roads of Qiyamah. This is a story.
That's why it's called Siyahat al-Gharb.
Western part of the universe.
Horizon. Yes, better
horizon.
Say, okay.
You know, because he considered his homeland, his country as East, Sham, and other parts of this homeland, which is other parts of the universe and world.
That's right.
As West, not what we call it, Western
countries. The other world,
here,
you mean?
This other world.
That's why Siyahat al-Sharq is an autobiography about himself.
About himself.
And Siyahat al-Gharb is about the other world.
The life of here and the life of hereafter.
Hereafter, okay.
There. Okay. So in both of the books, he tries to teach lessons lessons in morality. And it's in his book, Siyahat al-Gharb, he used a lot of hadith. It is not just some kind of story, like, yes, we have some novel. Yes. It's based on ayat, verses of Quran and hadith. And people like this book a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They printed and published this book for the first time in 1349.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, up to this day, we had a lot of republishing for this book. And even in the year 1382 in Iran,
yes,
there was a movie
yes,
based on this book. But
of this book. The main topic is about the other world. I mean, from the time of death to barzakh to the other world, the purgatory, okay? So many people have compared it to Divine Comedy by Dante, okay, mm-hmm, which is, again, a journey, a spiritual
yeah,
journey. And it fascinates so many minds from different classes of the society.
You know, there are two points about his book, which is the fascinating points of that. The first one is that he tried to, paint and draw different levels of Qiyamah,
mm-hmm,
different steps, one by one. You know,
okay,
if you want to check the Riwayah and Hadith about Qiyamah, there are different and various Hadiths,
yes,
but not in order. How are these steps? How are mm-hmm the levels?
So this is not something from his own mind.
No, based on Riwayah.
Okay,
you know,
okay,
but he made an order.
Uh-huh,
so
okay,
at the first time, yes, you die, you go to a grave.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happened after that?
Mm-hmm.
There was a resurrection. Then some Nakir and Munkar, some of the angels of God,
yes,
will ask you. You know, because it is in order like a journey. And this is mentioned in the book,
okay,
the journey. This is interesting for the readers. And the second point is art. I can say the second point is he used art to teach
mm-hmm
Islam.
Yes.
That is one of our weaknesses nowadays.
What do you mean by art? You mean literature?
Yes, literature.
Okay,
you know,
literature.
He used literature,
okay,
the art of writing,
the artistic
story,
form. Okay,
artistic
very good
form of. Yes. Today, as we can see, Western countries, they use media a lot. They
mm-hmm
use art a lot, different kinds of art.
Yes.
Painting, I don't know, music, cinema, everything, novels, in order to improve their ideology. But unfortunately, in this side, the side of Hav, we're so weak in the aspect of art. We just want to focus on science. This is not enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, science is good for me as a clergyman. I can check the books of science. But what about youth? They are not interested to scientific books. They don't search, I don't know, Wasilatul Najah, I don't know, the books like Mi'raj al-Sa'ada in order to be familiar
yes
with morality.
Yes.
You should get close to them with art.
Mm-hmm.
He did that, and I think this is the only unique book of
yes
akhlaq.
And this is the main reason why it was welcomed by so many
yes
people, ordinary
and
people.
Every part year they publish it again
yes
because this is the only book which is written for morality, for teaching Islamic idea and theology, but through art,
mm-hmm,
which is that story.
That's
so
right
we need it today. We
okay
need some more Agha Najafi Ghuchani
yes
in order to.
That's all right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
As we said, this book, Amin Siyahat al-Gharb, or the journey to the western part of horizon, is ayat and ahadith, okay? So this gives us something after this. I think very much authentic book in order for those who negate the hereafter, isn't it?
Yes. As you know, nowadays in our modern world, NDE or near-death experience,
mm-hmm,
it's something which is very much predominant. And there are lots of researchers are conducting research about
yes
this kind of phenomena. And it becomes really interested for the people, for the doctors, physicians, psychologists, that some people who have a short experience of death, after these kind of experiences, they express their own experiences. It's a kind of out-of-body experience. They say that we have seen and we have witnessed all the things that happened around our body.
Yes.
While the body was like a dead body, even sometimes it happens that the doctors orders to for that body to be buried because it is completely died.
Yes, for example, then, in a coma or something, unconsciousness.
Yeah, sometimes the person is completely died and the doctor tell the relatives to bury the body, but then suddenly or accidentally it comes back to the life. So when they narrate what happened to them outside the body, so it is a bit shocking for even the doctors and physicians. So that is why nowadays these kind of experiences are narrated by many people across the globe. So that is why when it comes to this Sayahat al-Gharb, it is a kind of narration of what happened after the death. But the main point about this is that it is a kind of authentic, kind of trustable source. Because the author of this book is an Ayatollah, a great scholar.
Yes.
He made use of ayat and riwayat. So he tried to explain and express what's going to happen after death based on authentic sources like ayat and riwayat. So that's why whatever expresses here by Ayatollah Khuchani would be more interesting, would be more useful and helpful for the youth rather than those kind of experiences that are narrated as NDE by the normal people.
As I said, this book has been compared to Divine Comedy by Dante. What is interesting, there are so many common points about the stages and about refraining from committing sins, okay, as an obstacle in order to grow up spiritually in both books. I mean, Divine Comedy by Dante and Siyahat al-Gharb by Aghana Rafiq Ghuchani, committing sin is considered as an obstacle. As we said, he has another book called Siyahat al-Sharq now. Let's get to this world, okay? So what is this book, Sheikh?
This book is about his biography.
It is an autobiography.
Autobiography, okay. Yes. He wrote about himself from his childhood up to the time that he was busy writing this book. But there are some, we can say there are some parts in his book, morality.
Yes.
We can see that there are a lot of moral hadith and ayah about that. And then some experience from history. How can we get lesson from history? For example, if I had something in my life, if I had a hardship, if I had some successes, how can we take a lesson from that? And then Islamic theology, while talking about his life, when you read this book, you can see among the sentences that he talked about himself, he tried to give his reader Islamic theology by the hadith and some socio-political items that we can see at that time, because he faced a lot of social, I don't know, phenomena and political phenomena. When he talks about this phenomena, he explains about that. There's a lesson how to care about society and politics. But I want to mention that an interesting point about this great author, which is the role of his father. Now, we just know him by his books, Siyahat al-Sharq, Siyahat al-Gharb. He's a jurist, he's a mystic. But we don't consider the role of his father. At his childhood, he wanted to stop education. He started education, and after some years, he wanted to just go to work and earn some money, like most of people at that time did. But his father insisted that he should continue education.
Yes.
You know, unless he did that, the father, unless he insisted on education, we wouldn't have any Agha Najafi Ghuchani and the interesting book, which is in the center of attention.
That's right.
So that is a lesson for us, the parents. You know, usual parents want to grow their children. How? By giving them some food, by buying clothes, I don't know, preparing some entertainment. This is not real parenting. Real parenting is to make a goal for your child. Of course, he should seek his interest.
Although his father was a farmer.
Yes, it was fun.
Yeah.
His father was not a scholar, just a father. Okay. He didn't study a lot.
Yes.
But he knew that although I, as a father, didn't study a lot, but science is important.
That's right.
You know, we can say that the real author of Siyarat al-Sharq and Siyarat al-Gharb is his father. Because of his role, so we can be we can be like his father in order to grow our children, not just their body, not just materialistic growth. We can grow their spirit as well and make them a leader for the world.
All right, really fascinating and fascinating field of study. I mean, they're studying about the purgatory. I mean, the barzakh, the other world, is really a difficult one. But Agha Najafi Ghuchani has dedicated his life to this one. And as you said, his autobiography is really interesting. Rabi Yosani, 26, in the year 1363, according to the Hijra calendar, he passed away at the age of 68 in the city of Quchan, and he was buried in the same Husseinia for 25 years. He has been busy with teaching students and teaching Islamic and ethical courses over there. May Allah bless the soul of the late Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Husseini, mainly known as Agha Najafi Quchani, the author of the books Siyahat al-Gharb and Siyahat al-Sharq. Thank you much, Sheikh Fadai.
You're welcome.
And Sheikh Rouhani, thank you very much. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. The another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
NATO foreign ministers discuss providing security guarantees.